Welcome to another episode of Yellow Let's Talk. Today we have Jillian Rogan with us. Thank you so much, Jillian, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Today I'd like us to dive into a discussion on the differences between anti-Semitism versus anti-Zionism, understanding the political landscape when discussing Palestinian liberation, and understanding Jewish identity as a whole as well. What is Zionism?
It's important to note that there are a lot of different conceptions of what Zionism is and a lot of different iterations of what it is. There's religious Zionism, political Zionism, but the Zionism that I think you're talking about is what's commonly referred to as modern political Zionism. It grew out of anti-Semitism, actually, in Europe. There were pogroms and mass persecution and discrimination and racism against Jewish people. The idea of normalization of Jewish people came about, and the way that Jews would become normal, and this quote-unquote normal, was to be able to have a state, a nation state, in terms of having a national identity. So Theodor Herzl, who's the father, often considered the father of modern Zionism, conceived of this idea that we needed to normalize the status of Jewish people, and to do that we would create a nation state, a nation for a homeland for Jewish people.
In your experience, what is a popular held belief about what Zionism is amongst Israelis or Jewish diaspora?
Many of us were taught from a young age that being Jewish means being supportive of the state of Israel as our homeland. You know, I didn't grow up in a religious Jewish household. My relatives, my ancestors are communists, so not so much with the religion. I always find it really interesting. I didn't go to Hebrew school, or I wasn't connected to a synagogue. I wasn't told explicitly these things. Like many, many of my Jewish friends and community members have been sort of told this by Jewish institutional community affiliations. I wasn't. But yet, you know, at every Jewish holiday, we had a little box for the Jewish National Fund. It's a blue box with the Star of David, and you're supposed to give money, tzedakah, charity to, and that goes to, I mean, I didn't know until much later that it goes to buying land, you know, for stealing land, expropriating land, you know, and so it was always there as part of my upbringing. And it's always really interesting to me how insidious it was, that it was just assumed that we're Jewish, we go to Israel, we love Israel, you know. Even though my parents were very critical thinkers, and my father was even critical of parts of the state of Israel and things like that. But yet, when I was 18, I did what all of my cousins and my sister had done, and I went to a kibbutz, and I learned Hebrew, and I went to Israel without question. It was just like everybody else did. This is what I'm going to do.
Why do you think Zionist Jews will call anti-Zionist Jews self-hating Jews?
I think there's many people have been taught that being Jewish means being invested in the idea that part of being Jewish is supporting the state of Israel as a Jewish collective. And many people are taught that the reason why people don't like Israel or criticize Israel is because they're anti-Semitic, full stop. That's the end of the story. So I think it's just become, for many people, sort of thought to be inextricably linked to Jewish identity, Jewish. But I don't believe that.
Do you think Zionism has similarities to white supremacy?
Yes.
How so?
Zionism was conceived of by European Jewish men, I would say, largely. And it was modeled after whiteness, right? And to the extent that Mizrahi Jews and Sephardic Jews in Israel are kind of taught, told, coerced into assimilation, right? You're supposed to rid yourself of the Arabic language. Arabic is a language of Jews historically. You know, I have a friend who identifies as a Palestinian Jew. That's a thing, right? Jews were always in Palestine. Her family left because they were not happy with Zionism. They did not want to lose their Arabic tongue. They liked their food and culture, and they were very much embedded in Arabic life. They were Arabs. You know, they are Arabs. That is not part of Zionism. So there's a very much a white assimilationist process that happens, I think. And many have written about this, Noor Erekat and Elo Shohad and others.
How did Jewish racial identity shift to whiteness?
How did that happen? I think there's not one simple answer. I agree with much of what Karen Brodkin says, but I also think that becoming white, what does it mean? What does it mean to become like Canadians, become like Europeans? What do European states and Canadian states and America, what and Israel, what do? They colonize. They're settler colonial projects, you know, at least North America, Australia, New Zealand. How do you become white? You join white supremacy. You know, you join the goals of white supremacy. I think that's in part how you, how one becomes white. And I think it's a very false sense of security. I think it, one of my colleagues, Abby Bakken, writes about becoming white by permission. It's precarious. When you have a history of being racialized, I don't know that you can ever fully become white. You can sit at the edges, you can, but I, and that resonates with me, white by permission, and it's temporary and it's capable of changing.
Right? Can you walk us just through how the definition has changed to include saying free Palestine or from river to the sea, Palestine will be free, is anti-Semitic?
There's not one definition of anti-Semitism. It's something that scholars and activists and people write about constantly, especially recently, to try to untangle this mess of trying to understand it. My understanding in terms of my research is that prior to 1967, the Israeli state wasn't that interested or invested in dealing with or looking at anti-Semitism in the diaspora, because the whole state exists to say, well, once Israel exists, there will be no more anti-Semitism. This is the answer. This is the antidote. So to the extent that Israel was asked to, or maybe not, was it was looking at anti-Semitism in the diaspora, they said, no, we don't, that's not really our problem. Come to Israel if you have a problem with your life in America or life in Canada or Europe. You know, that's the solution. After 1967, there were widespread, lots of critiques about the use of force that Israel demonstrated, the militarization, the occupation, and their policies began to shift as a state, and they became invested in thinking of trying to clarify their image as a nation state. And really, it became at that time part of Israeli state kind of interest to talk about critiques of Israel as anti-Semitic.
How has anti-Semitism been embedded in Canadian laws and policies?
I think historically, and it wasn't just directed towards Jews, but there were explicit laws, practices, daily practices, policies that explicitly were racist and anti-Semitic. You know, there were limits on the numbers of Jews, quotas about how many Jews could get into certain universities. You can't have too many. There was an official state policy of none is too many, and that was sort of during World War II when Jewish refugees were trying to get into Canada. And we also need to think about that in terms of Palestine, right? Mm-hmm. Part of the reason that Jewish people went to Palestine was because nobody would take them. They were refugees coming from other places. So, the U.S. and Canada shut their borders to Jewish people. They were fleeing Europe, and we need to think about Canada's responsibility in that, right? In what's going on now. This is not just a conflict or genocidal campaign that involves Israel and Palestine. Britain bears responsibility, Canada bears responsibility, but in terms of laws and practices, it was literally everything. There was discrimination in housing, there was, you would see signs, no Jews or black people allowed. On a beach, on a public beach, at vacation sites, you know, there was daily anti-Semitism embedded in Canadian laws, practices, policies. Again, it wasn't just Jews, it was against many black people, racialized people, Chinese people, Japanese people. You know, we have a long, long history of explicit racist laws and legal systems in Canada. And our current systems, maybe we don't have explicit laws, we still have racist immigration laws, you know. Mm-hmm. But I would say that I can't think of any explicit anti-Semitic law or policy that's in place today. I guess that's complicated.
Jewish Voices for Peace and Independent Jewish Voices, because you're part of those organizations. And I feel like a lot of people might want to know more about what does Jewish Voices for Peace stand for?
I really can't speak on behalf of Jewish Voice for Peace. I'll tell you a little bit about what I do. I mean, they stand for anti-racism and liberation in Palestine, but the one project I work with them on is a workshop called Wrestling with Zionism. And it's designed for people who are having questions about the relationship with Zionism. And it's really, you know, a facilitated workshop to try to help people think through it. And in an environment where we're not going to yell and debate, and, you know, it's a storytelling kind of workshop. And that's really the extent of my involvement with JVP. But JVP and IJV are sort of sister organizations. JVP is based in the States and IJV is based in Canada.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Independent Jewish Voices in Canada and what they stand for?
Yeah, I mean, if you look on our website, we have a basis of unity. We stand for anti-racism. We stand for Palestine justice in Palestine, justice for Palestinians and for Israelis. We stand for, we're against Israeli apartheid. We support the boycott, divestment, sanction movement. We are opposed to settler colonization in Canada and in Israel. And we're an anti-racist movement.
Anti-racist movement. Mm-hmm. I think that's the overall theme of this episode, is really understanding that we are moving towards anti-racism when we're talking about anti-Zionism or talking about anti-Semitism or Islamophobia or anti-Palestinian rhetoric. Right now, we are seeing a very polarized landscape. And a lot of people are having trouble having conversations, whether it's having conversations within their own household or having conversations on social media or within the workforce, trying to tell their employers, hey, the statements you're put out are not making me feel safe. What advice would you like to give to those people?
I don't know that I have broad-based advice. You know, I think that in my experience, debates are not helpful. I think what's really important is to be able to understand people's feelings and where they're coming from, as opposed to engaging in fact-based debates that often don't go anywhere and result in really polarized conversations. But I do think it's really important to have understanding of where people with opposing views, where their feelings are coming from. You know, what do they feel is at stake? Like what? And that often is an entryway into the conversation. And then at the same time that I'm saying that, I'm thinking, well, we can't stop talking about Palestine right now. You know, we have to say it. We have to take risks. We have to know that there's people out there to support us. But everybody needs to take responsibility for their own sense of safety and what they can do, and connecting with things that can make them feel more safe, which is often solidarity, you know, community, and taking care of each other.
Thank you for sharing some of your research with us on what it is right now and how it has changed and evolved over time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank everyone who listened to this special segment on Yellow Let's Talk. Please don't forget to rate, comment, subscribe. At the same time, please, please continue speaking up. Please, please continue advocating for a better world to live in. And don't forget to follow IJV and Jewish Voices for Peace. And really, let's stand in solidarity together. Thank you.